You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio. You just found the very best in original talk radio broadcasting on the internet. It's LA Talk Radio. We say what we want. You're listening to On the Couch, with Dr. Michelle on LA Talk Radio.
This is Dr. Michelle Cohen, and you are officially on the couch. Welcome, everyone. This is the place where you can put your feet up if you want. Get comfortable. But also get some insight that might relate to some things going on in your life. Whether it's how to handle the stress and anxiety and the craziness going around all of us. How managing relationships. Getting a handle on that low self-esteem. Trying to cope with those difficult people in our lives. Taking a look at yourself and what you're contributing to it too, huh? Or whatever. The deal is I'm here to give you suggestions on how to help you with some good changes. How to sort of see what's going on around you and, you know, manage your anxiety and other issues that you're trying to cope with. And, of course, you and I do not have a therapeutic relationship here on the air, but what I do is I just try to give you some suggestions, help you out. You know, we talk the talk together, and I always encourage you to call me if you have a question or if you would like to email me. You can do so as well. If you're shy, you don't want to get your voice on the air. My phone number here, 323-203-0815, 323-203-0815. You're in Los Angeles. We'd love to hear from you anywhere you're at all over the world. Come on down. You can email me as well, as I mentioned, if you are a little hesitant about getting your voice on the air. You have something intimate to talk about. You don't want to put it out there for fear someone may know you. Go ahead, email me, Doc Michelle, DLC Michelle, hooked up right here at the station, docmichelle@aol.com. And, you know, I'll try to answer your question if I can help you out. You know, I always enjoy the perspective from my expert guests as well. You've been here with me a while, right, guys? I have authors and self-help specialists, and they always add so much, you know, to helping you with your issues. So today I'm talking about post-traumatic stress disorder, or syndrome, as we call it, PTSD. Not a happy subject, really. But, I've worked with a lot of people who've not only suffered from some of the experiences that they've had in the military, being in combat, but also, you know, traumatic experiences such as abuse, verbal, physical, growing up with that on a daily basis, sexual attacks, even car accidents, things that come out of the blue, losses that we experience in our lives from our loved ones that just happen sometimes. I mean, that can cause PTSD, things that shock us. Literally shock our brains, and we don't know how to deal with it because we're not sort of equipped to do that. I mean, we do have the fight or flight little part of our brain in order to survive. But now there's so much going on, and we don't have to run from the tigers out there. Well, maybe we do. Yeah, the ones on Wall Street, sure. But you know what I'm talking about. We don't have to fight the animals to survive and, you know, kick into fight or flight. We don't have to do that anymore. But when things happen, our brains go kablooey. Now, isn't that a psychiatric description that's accurate? And what happens is we don't know how to deal with it, and we go into shock, and we have all of these different, you know, experiences. Strange things. We think we're going crazy. People look at us. We don't know how to handle it. So, I was reading several hours ago an article which came out from our CBS network affiliate in Canada about Ottawa. And it's complaining about their military planners in being too slow, you know, to deal with the psychological after effects of war. The Afghanistan soldiers coming back to Canada. You know, the psychological after effects of war don't decrease or go away after a mission ends. To the contrary, they can increase year by year and last lifetimes. I mean, many, many decades of just coping with this. And I know this is kind of a downer, but I'm leading to something. So hang in here with me. And I want to hear your feedback, guys. This is kind of a frightening statistic. CBS News reported that some 22 American heroes take their own lives every day because of the stresses they experienced on the battlefield. And so many more don't get the treatment they need, and they find their life spiraling out of control. I don't know if you heard the show or not, but 60 Minutes correspondent Steve Croft hosted Combat Stress, Finding the Way Home. It was a special radio hour, and it kind of checked out the impact of post-traumatic stress disorder on our nation's veterans. It was broadcast during Memorial Day weekend. It was a great show. Fascinating. Really got a lot of people thinking about how they can help. Relatives, friends, themselves. You know, and again, PTSD can be found in any kind of situation. People who've been in, like I said, car accidents, victims of assaults, sexual attacks, Holocaust survivors, of course, indeed, any wars, you know. I didn't really come out PTSD until, about 1980. Yeah, the American Psychiatric Association added it to the Manual for Mental Disorders back in about 1980. But even then it was controversial because, you know, the trigger was considered to be something outside the patient's psyche, which it was, but sometimes we all have different kinds of coping mechanisms. We don't know how to deal with it. Do we have a chemical propensity towards it? You know, did a relative or relatives, grandma, grandpa, so were they more easily triggered by trauma? And therefore, I got the gene or whatever. I don't know. But there's a lot of exploration and research, and they're really finding out a lot more about it, and rightly so, because so many people are suffering nowadays from it. I don't want to go into suffering today on the show, and oh my God, this feels bad, but I want to share with you information so you can identify this, maybe within yourself, from trauma you've experienced, or in a family member or a friend, and you want to help them. But we're also talking today about a lot of survivors from the war, specifically Vietnam. I do have a special guest, one of my favorites, psychiatrist, author, who's going to share some insights. He's got a new book I'll be telling you about in just a bit. But we're also going to be talking about how people, you know, view some of the things going on in the media. Movies, novels, things we read, things we see, things we experience that are outside of our reality. And do we take this stuff in? Can we become traumatized? Is this why we have the ratings for movies? Give me a break on some of those PG-13 movies. Come on. I wouldn't take my 16-year-old to go see one of those movies. Really? Anyway. That's a whole other show. We'll go there. Maybe we'll touch on it a little bit today. But the thing is that, you know, what's happening is a lot of things that we're seeing, a lot of trauma, and game shows. Not game shows. Well, they're kind of traumatizing too. Actually, my son went on Fear Factor. And that was quite traumatizing. But we'll talk about that another day too. Nonetheless, I wanted to talk about the exposure that we have just in everyday viewing of our news as well. Going to the movies, seeing something that's really dramatically horrifying or scary. And I want to talk about all those things. But I'd really like to talk about my special guest, first of all. His name's Dr. Mark Rubenstein. He's a physician, psychiatrist, clinical assistant professor of psychiatry at Cornell University's Medical School. And before turning to fiction, he co-authored 5 medical self-help books. He's also written 3 mystery thrillers about folks involved in life and death struggles. Many times with forces they can't control. And you may be familiar with Dr. Rubenstein because he's been a guest on my show before, talking about his novel Love Gone Mad. Oh, that was so cool. And Mad Dog House. We've had amazing discussions about things like what causes someone to become a psychopath. And, you know, other mental disorders as well. So today we're talking about his latest novella. It's called The Foot Soldier. It's about the trauma of war and those who suffer from PTSD. And we have him with us right now. Hi, Dr. Rubenstein. How are you? Nice to have you.
It's great to be with you, Michelle. And it's Mark. It's not Doctor.
Mark, you know what? Thank you. I love that. And I'm Michelle. So there you go. We're buddies here. That's okay. Right. We're old friends by now, of course.
Right.
You know, I really enjoyed reading your book, The Foot Soldier. And as a woman, you know, I am not as into, say, military stories. I'm fascinated with films that depict the, you know, reality in war. But I'm not really into reading as much as a lot of my male friends and my husband. You know, they love to listen to a lot of different military-style books. But this, to me, was fascinating because the way you explained it, the way you laid it out, and, you know, it was just, it was a great novel. It read quickly. And I want to talk more about the novel and how you do focus on PTSD and how these people that you've dealt with in your life as a psychiatrist, you know, have coped and are coping. So anyway, thank you again for coming. And
thank you for the kind comments. I appreciate that. I got all of that in about 55 pages, so, you know.
You did well.
It's a short novella,
But it's really informative, and it gets to the point, and the story is very intriguing the way you build up to it. And it's true, and I'm sure it's taken from a lot of true stories that you've heard in your practice.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, over the years, I've treated many combat veterans, mostly from Vietnam, but now they come in from Iraq and Afghanistan, too.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, this was based on the history of the war in Vietnam and some of the horrors that these young men endured.
Mm. Yes, that's a perfect word for it. So as a forensic psychiatrist, I do want to get into, you know, the trauma of war, but can you tell us more about some of the situations and people that you have helped who've suffered from PTSD and their traumas that they've experienced?
Sure. Over the years, I've seen hundreds upon hundreds, if not thousands. Just to give you a quick, for instance,
mm-hmm.
Following the 9/11 terrorist attack, I evaluated and some of them I treated more than 300 survivors,
wow.
People who were actually in the towers when the planes struck, respectively, towers 1 and 2.
My God.
These were all people who were at work, and I saw them in the context of basically workers' compensation situations because they were physically and emotionally damaged by what had taken place while they were sitting at their desks or you know, standing over a cup of coffee. In addition, as I said before, I've treated and evaluated various war veterans. In the context of forensic psychiatry, I've been involved in various litigations and testifying in court and evaluating litigants and claimants, people who have suffered through rape, believe it or not, people who have survived airplane crashes from 30-odd thousand feet.
Oh, my God.
People who have survived explosions, the collapses of buildings. There was a very famous plaza that was going up in Bridgeport, Connecticut back some years ago called Ambiance Plaza. And in the midst of the construction, the whole thing literally collapsed as though there was an earthquake, killing and injuring severely over 100 workers, and I saw a number of the survivors in consultation, some of them in treatment, and of course I ended up seeing some of the I don't have to tell you, some of the survivors had survivor's guilt because their best friend or coworker had died. You name the traumatic incident, and I've seen people who've survived them, from a catastrophic automobile accident in which a spouse or a child died. You name it, and it's been part of the repertoire of forensic psychiatry. I've even ended up evaluating on the criminal side some people in penitentiaries, the whole issue of not guilty by reason of insanity sometimes arises, but that's of course not PTSD. But I would say that in the forensic arena, the two most common diagnoses that are applicable tend to be PTSD and depression.
Wow, that is fascinating.
With PTSD, of course, having the most dramatic impact and arising from the most dramatic and otherworldly catastrophic kinds of events. People trapped under... it goes on and on. I mean, I've heard of, incidents and accidents and things that I would never have dreamed of in fiction that occur to real people. A man falling from the 15th floor of a scaffolding cleaning windows, and lived to talk about it because he was lucky enough to land on about 30 or 40 pieces of plywood that were piled on top of each other. And there was a bit of maybe an eighth or a quarter of an inch of air cushion between each plywood, because I'm sure, as you can imagine, they're all slightly a bit warped, you know? So he bounced up after, it was almost unbelievable a man could fall from that height and be severely injured, but can you imagine those couple of seconds during which he was falling?
You know, we're talking about the situations, and maybe a lot of people don't understand, you know, they hear about PTSD and they get glimpses on the news. I just talked about the CBS special for 1 hour that came out on Veterans Day, and of course the article that came out this morning from Canada about Ottawa's negligence in helping the soldiers there, and you know, all the suffering from Afghanistan. But you know, those are the situations. Maybe you could enlighten some of the listeners about the symptoms. You know, in other words, how's that fear that you just described of the man falling so far down, and symptoms, you know, that come with a diagnosis of PTSD, different from folks who've, you know, experienced, say, generalized fears? And I know you see these patients as well as I do. You know, losing their job, worrying about being alone the rest of their lives, never finding a relationship, not having enough money. What are some of these symptoms that are just so glaring that people should be aware of?
Sure, Michelle. The things you just mentioned, you know, not having enough money, concerns about, let's say, a marriage or relationships or being alone or even being fired or whatever, these are anxieties anybody can have. They really are part and parcel of living life and adjusting to the whims and fancies that life throws us through, and we just have to negotiate those wins. But PTSD follows a catastrophic event that, as you know, is beyond the range of usual or ordinary human circumstances, that the person experiences in a very primal way, as an imminent threat of destruction or annihilation by other people or by some situation, be it an earthquake, a tsunami, an explosion, a robbery at gunpoint, a mugging, a rape, mob situations. The symptoms are really far more severe and all-encompassing and really are global as compared to the sort of ordinary anxieties in life. These are people who, of course, suffer from what are commonly known as flashbacks, which are vivid, ultra vivid recollections of the event itself or of some facsimile of the event that occur even during the daytime. And when they occur at night, of course, they are basically dreams. They are nightmares that awaken the person, usually in a cold sweat and trembling. These people who fear, literally fear going to sleep because of these recurrent repetitive nightmares. They have recurrent intrusive recollections. These are also people who avoid anything that either symbolizes or in some way resembles the traumatic event. The classical example is of a soldier who, let's say, survived Vietnam knew that, you know, half of his platoon was wiped out. Well, you know, 5 years later, he's back in the U.S. He's a civilian again. He's doing whatever he does.
Right.
He takes a plane trip down to Florida, and he gets off the plane, leaves the airport, and as soon as he gets outside that air-conditioned airport, he sees the palm trees, and he feels the humidity of the air. He breaks out in literally a bone-chilling cold sweat because the atmosphere is so reminiscent of Vietnam and being in the bush. These are just some of the hallmarks. There's also generalized anxiety that goes along with it, and oftentimes what's really called a foreshortened sense of the future. These are people who've survived such catastrophic scenarios, and this really typifies, for instance, concentration camp survivors, a number of whom I've evaluated over the years, who really have the life draining sense that nothing matters anymore. They're almost nihilistic. They say, well, what's the difference? In the end, we're going to die anyway. After what I've been through, I mean, who cares if the mortgage doesn't get...
It's
the kind of person who says, why should I bother making my bed in the morning? I'm only going to undo the bed at night. It's as though nothing is worth pursuing or living for, and these are often joyless people. They have lost the capacity for joy. In a more melodramatic thing, and I mentioned this as a little footnote at the end of Love Gone Mad, Henrik Ibsen coined the phrase soul murder in one of his plays, these are people who in some respects have had their souls virtually damped down and stamped out, and who no longer can really experience a sense of joyfulness in what life may have to offer them. And these are some of the symptoms. There are many others, but the main ones are the intrusive thoughts, recollections, the nightmares, the inability to tolerate even being in anything that symbolizes or resembles a traumatic event.
And not to mention the high startle reflex.
Exaggerated startle reflex. A Vietnam vet hears a tire blow hears a firecracker or something like that. They jump as high as the moon.
They
are just so... They are primed. Their entire autonomic nervous system is primed to react as though they're still in that situation. You know, I often term PTSD, it's almost the person remembers too well. He can't forget. She cannot get it out of her mind. She relives it. It's a fault line of reliving the trauma.
And again, it doesn't necessarily have to be those who have suffered or had horrible experiences in wartime. It can be due to severe abuse, growing up in a home of, you know, constant trauma, being abandoned, you know, having a loved one suddenly pass away. I mean, things that literally shock our brains into unreality that we're not...
Even hearing about a loved one, particularly if it's a violent death suffered by the loved one, can precipitate post-traumatic stress disorder. If someone is unfortunately told that his loved one or her loved one died in a terrible fire or automobile accident, that can kick it into gear. Of course, it's become the diagnosis that is not only more easily recognized, but as we all know, it's become abused also. I'm thinking specifically of the Jodi Arias case.
Oh, yeah, it really has. No, well said.
They tried to foist that on the court, and nobody bought it. I mean...
Exactly. Hey, we'll try anything we can here, you know?
Well, that's the defense's job.
That's exactly right. That's right. You know, and it has become sort of used in defense, you know, situations in courtrooms, as has, you know, the popularity of bipolar disorder. Everyone has bipolar disorder now, right? blame it on
you
them.
You and I included, Michelle.
That's right, because, you know, when we're naughty and we act out, oh, it's my manic's kicking in. You know, I just couldn't help myself. That's right. By the way, in case you just tuned in here, you're on the couch with Dr. Michelle here on LA Talk Radio. And we're talking today about PTSD specifically, but I invite you to call in if you'd like to share some experiences that you may have had and how you have overcome them or trying to get help. Here live on the air, 323-203-0815. 323-203-0815. If you're shy, you'd rather email me, docmichelle@AOL.com. Right here, hooked up to the station, I can get you on and read your question. And my special guest today, Dr. Mark Rubenstein, he's the author of his latest novella. He's, you know, authored so many self-help books and his great other fiction novels. But The Foot Soldier is just out. It's a great book. It's about the trauma of war and those who suffer from PTSD. Specifically about a soldier in his battalion, which we'll get into just a little bit. We want to just tease you because you got to pick up the book, guys. You got to read through it. We can't tell you the whole thing. You know what I'm saying? This is not the cliff note on the air. This is you got to get the book. So, what really fascinates me about you, Mark, is that as a novelist and psychiatrist, you know, you've become intimate with fear, and this is what you say. You love writing about it. So I'm interested in you. What is it? You are on the couch. What is it about the subject of fear that fascinates you so much?
Well, I think most of us, without even realizing it, spend much of our lives trying to ameliorate or escape from fear, or in an attenuated form from anxiety. We live our lives really, for the most part, we're safe. We expect to get in the car, go to work, come home, live a relatively uneventful life. Yes, occasionally a surprise may occur, but fear is such a primal experience.
Yeah.
It activates a part of the brain that really is very primitive, that was part of the human anatomy and psyche going back millions of years. It's what kept the human species alive, because we were really ill-equipped physically to deal with predators. And the fear response is something that, in my view, probably accounts ultimately for, well, for better or worse, for civilization having come about the way it has, people banding together, even taking dogs to help them in their hunting so that they could be more effective in obtaining food, learning how to plant and grow and gather as well as hunt, because in numbers there was safety in villages, in sects, in families. There is some safety. You go back to the farmers of 100 years ago, even in America, they often had 10-12 kids because they wanted someone who would be there to take care of them as they got older, more infirm. I mean, it's really a kind of undercurrent in all our lives to one extent or another, whether it's fear of abandonment, the fear of being harmed, the fear of being an owner of a Beale crash, fear of that horrific adrenalized flow of energy when you're facing something horrific. I find that I must tell you that writing about it, I think the essence of storytelling is to lure the reader in and have the reader want to turn the page, partly out of concern, worry, fear, and also out of curiosity as to, oh my God, what's going to happen next?
I mean,
above all, you know, Isaac Bashevis Singer was once he's a Nobel laureate, and he was being lauded in all these literary and intellectual things. He got up and he said, you know what, I'm just a storyteller, that's all. So I think the essence of storytelling is to strike at the primal essence of people. If you look at at Gillian Flynn's best-selling novel, Gone Girl.
Yeah.
It's about this dysfunctional marriage, two unreliable narrators, the husband, Nick, and the wife, whose name escapes me for the moment.
Right.
And there's a question as to whether she's dead, and there's a question, did he murder her, and
right.
what happened, and you keep going from chapter to chapter to chapter, and you're getting closer and closer to the end point, and you still can't be certain, and then you realize that neither one of them is reliable at all in the narration.
Yeah, exactly.
But it keeps you going. It keeps you engaged. It keeps
exactly.
you fascinated.
So it is fascinated and fascinating rather. And I love that about your book, The Foot Soldier, because it does. I mean, again, as a woman, you know, reading a military story, I just wanted to. I couldn't flip the pages enough to continue what was happening. I guess he was a soldier. His name was Costa. But you really do in your book, and I just want to touch on this a little bit, talk about the terror and fear that is experienced by specifically 8 soldiers. They meet up with a Bravo company in Da Nang. That's Vietnam, of course. For about a year, that was the service that they were drafted into.
1 year back.
Yeah.
Then. Yep.
Mm-hmm. And you take us on a journey written in the first person by the main character. It's Private Costa, right? So can you give listeners just a taste about what he and his 2nd Battalion group have to endure, particularly, on the good guys and the bad guys, and the good guys and the bad guys? Johnson is a kind of a bad guy. I mean, but can he help himself? I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know. Well, Costa's a 21-year-old kid. I'm at the age now where 21 is just a kid.
Yeah.
barely out of infancy. And he extended his student deferment for as long as he could. He's from the Buffalo region of New York State. And he is drafted. This is back in the Vietnam War era, and he's drafted right out of, virtually the day he finishes college, he gets the notice. And it begins with, it was June, and I got off the plane at Da Nang, and the heat and the humidity hit him like a blast furnace. And the novella takes you through his experience with Bravo Company, and they're in the bush, as they called it in those days, humping the bush, which is really the jungle.
Right.
And they are on a search and destroy mission, and they have to go deep into Viet Cong territory, and they must deal with the heat, the debilitating humidity, the mosquitoes, the leeches, the fatigue, drinking water and gobbling salt tablets like M&M's, and the absolute fear and of an unseen enemy lurking perhaps behind any bit of foliage. And it's the fear of the unknown, of as Costa says in essence to the reader, he was walking what was called point. That is the first man leading the platoon or the squad, and he imagines a bullet ripping through his chest. He is commanded. The company is commanded by a Lieutenant Johnson, who's not a nice guy. He is a bit on the paranoid side. Very racist. He never met a Vietnamese he didn't want to kill.
Lovely.
And the novella takes us through the trek of this company, and really, I know it is a war novella, but it's really a story about a man trying to keep his soul intact. This young man, Costa. And it's about split-second decisions that people have to make in the midst of warfare in the jungle, whether they're right or wrong.
Right.
And where rank takes precedence, but when you receive an order that defies everything you thought was right and good about the human soul, what do you do?
Exactly.
And these are not easy questions to answer, because we all know the famous dictum, I was only following orders.
That's right. And that's when we talk about, our own human morality and what do we do? What do we do? And I know in your story, and I won't get into it because I really encourage folks to pick this up and read it. It's wonderful reading and informative and historic. also let you know about suffering from PTSD and what it's about. But people like Lieutenant Johnson, as you described, you know, he's racist, he's cold-blooded, he's everybody, every Viet Cong he wants to kill, every village, he mistrusts anyone.
He wants to torch them all and
right.
poison all the wells.
There
and,
you go. Yeah,
he said, you know, there are no friendlies out there.
Right.
Every Vietnamese is a Charlie.
Right.
Charlie. You know, which was
That's
the
right.
shorthand term for Viet Cong.
That's right.
VC. And
right.
There yeah. were guys like that
yeah.
out there back then.
Yeah.
You know,
exactly.
The amazing thing about that war, and really about all wars preceding Iraq Iraq and Afghanistan, mm-hmm. was that. You know, Costa was a draftee, and
yeah.
were all the men, except a couple, in the company. And
right.
when you have a war being fought by draftees, it's a very different scenario, and that was a very different time
right. exactly.
Than what's happening now. And,
right.
It had to be very difficult to be drafted and sent to
my God. Oh, my God, yeah, exactly. So, you know, just to touch a little bit, this Lieutenant Johnson is, you know, described a pretty negative person, pretty messed up man who is paranoid and all that stuff. And he forces Costa to commit murder, and I'm not going to get into it, but or Costa will be killed himself. And there we have the moral dilemma. What are we going to do? What are we going to do? What do you think happens to people like Lieutenant Johnson, who's been, he sounds like a lifer, as they call them, you know, mm-hmm. to make him so paranoid and cold-blooded?
I wish I had an easy answer.
Yeah, yeah.
God only knows what he went through, the lust for power, the need to command other men, the need to be so vengeful and hateful. It's hard to know where that comes from.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've seen it before. We've seen it. There was the My Lai massacre in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
This, by the way, is not an anti-war screed of any.
Right.
It is a tale of morality, but
mm-hmm.
but you know, I couldn't help but think of My Lai when mm-hmm. I was writing this. But without getting into the novella itself, it's very difficult to really. I mean, he's a character I created, and I never really gave much thought to. My God, what when I guess I could have done a novel, you know, a 350-page novel, and perhaps mm-hmm. gotten a bit more into Johnson's character, the whys and the wherefores,
mm-hmm.
but I really wanted to present primarily the dilemmas
yes.
facing a man like Costa, who only the reader only knows him as Costa.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know his first name, and you know a bit about him and his background,
yeah.
and you know his mother was a lunch lady at Lackawanna High School.
Right,
his
right.
His father worked in the steel mill.
Yeah,
and,
pretty normal
you know,
life, and here he is drafted all of a sudden, and he had the courage to go to college, and boom, he's all of a sudden in Da Nang.
he's packing 70 yeah. pounds of gear on
wow.
his back, and mm. with 15, I forget what they're called, you know, the packets of bullets, trekking through the jungle
yeah.
and enduring the almost unendurable.
Yeah, exactly.
And,
wow.
Sleeping at night. I
yeah.
mean, they couldn't sleep. They each man had to go on watch, and the mosquitoes were horrifying.
Oh, yeah.
You couldn't slap
oh, God,
the mosquitoes
yeah.
because the
yeah.
enemy would hear that.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Oh, my God. Exactly.
It's unimaginable.
It's fascinating.
You try to imagine.
No, just unimaginable. That's exactly right, I think. By the way, in case you just tuned in here to LA Talk Radio, you're on the couch with Dr. Michelle, and my special guest today is Dr. Mark Rubenstein. He's a physician, psychiatrist, clinical assistant professor of psychiatry at Cornell University's Medical School, and of course, he's an author. He's authored many self-help books, and he's a wonderful fiction writer as well. He's written novels. You've heard him before, Love Gone Mad. We've spoken about Mad Doghouse. Lovely discussions about psychopaths. I love this stuff. you know. But today we're talking about your novella, The Foot Soldier. It's your latest book out, a good read. And as a woman, as I mentioned, I was fascinated by the military story. I don't usually get into those kinds of books, but this was great. It's about the trauma of war and those who suffer from PTSD. And you're a specialist as well in all of this, but I'm going to just skew it a little bit, and I don't mean to keep focusing on Lieutenant Johnson, okay? But I wanted to just kind of move this a little bit over to what a lot of us deal with in our daily reality in the media, and, you know, exposing our children to violence. And now I'm taking out, you know, abusive homes. I'm taking out rape and trauma and things like that that really cause a lot of PTSD. But can you explain, I've always been fascinated, what is the difference between people like Lieutenant Johnson, who was possibly a lifer and exposed to hell, but he loved the war and he loved that power and he was, you know, as opposed to him and someone who has antisocial personality disorder, or of course sociopathic disorder, as they call it, like Jeffrey Dahmer, a murderer, Ted Bundy, or the stalker in your book, we talked about Love Gone Mad. What's the difference between this kind of crazy mind?
Yeah, well, you know, the Jeffrey Dahmers of the world, and these are in essence they suffer from various forms of perversity, of sexual perversity, where you know they either rape or torture or kill, and in Dahmer's case, of course, even partially ate his victims. They are serial killers in times of peace, as opposed to Johnson, who was an opportunist for his more base and ugly elements of his personality and soul in a time of war when this behavior was quasi-sanctioned, or at least he could get away with it. That's not to say he would be incapable of becoming like a Jeffrey Dahmer, but these people, the Dahmers of the world, they typically had such repellent childhoods that they grow up with such a distorted image of themselves and of others that for them to laud power in some way, it becomes sexualized, and they basically act out these very sick bodily sexual fantasies. Someone like Johnson is really acting out a power game in which he lusts not just for power, but the power to have the ability to say who lives and who dies in a time and situation that specifically says you're empowered to do this. You know, you're in a hostile VC area, so you can burn the friendly, the non-friendlies. Someone like the stalker in Love Gone Mad, well, he was just plain paranoid, although he was in many ways right for all the wrong reasons.
That's correct.
He had a terrible childhood, and most people with severe pathology, whatever they take to the game in terms of their constitutions and genetics, they still have, for the most part, have had terrible childhoods. It's the old nature-nurture controversy. I think there's never going to be a real singular answer. I think everything, you know, you can send 50 men in a platoon into wartime combat. 5 or 10 will come back with PTSD, and the others won't.
And so,
you know, the same horrific experience and circumstance doesn't affect everybody the same way. So there's some nature, that is, there's some genetic coding that goes on there. But in addition, there's the nurturing or the lack thereof.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, there's just no easy answer. They say psychopaths are, you know, incapable of changing, of being treated. They can't even form a therapeutic alliance with a therapist. And I think that's true. They try to con everybody, and they are manipulative, and They can't relate to a therapist as though that person is there to help, but they relate to a therapist in terms of, how can I con you? How can I make you like me and trust me?
Exactly.
And then how can I take advantage? I've had a few in treatment over the years, and they were the only people over a 41-year career who never paid my bill.
There you go. Exactly. I bet. You know what? That's about right. You got it. Comes under the, personality disorder, narcissism. Here we go. Producer says we have a caller up on the line. Let's pull this and see if we have somebody who'd like to chat with you. Hi, you're on the air with Dr. Michelle and Dr. Mark Rubenstein. Who's this? Hello.
Hi, doctors. This is Mike.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I'm doing good, thank you.
Good. Did you have a question about our subject today or for Dr. Rubenstein?
Well, I just caught the show right now. What's the subject?
We're talking about PTSD today. And people, you know, who have suffered from, you know, being in traumatic situations. Specifically, we're talking about Dr. Rubenstein's novel, The Foot Soldier. And it's about the trauma of war and people who've, gone into, war situations and, come out suffering from a lot of their experiences. So did you have something you wanted to add?
Mm-hmm. You can actually put me on. I don't have any questions per se. I just wanted to take a listen to the show.
Okay. Well, great to have you, and I appreciate you calling in. Have a good one. All right. Bye-bye. Well, okay. That's fine. It's nice to have folks just give us kudos and say, like the show. So there we go. Let's move along, Mark, if we can. I was reading your Huffington Post article recently.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that was a good one. And it's where you talk about such stories as Stephen King's Gerald's Game, Thomas Harris's The Silence of the Lambs. You know, I think I have PTSD from that vision of Anthony Hopkins with a full face piece on saying, Clarice. You know, it's just, really? But, you know, most of us have read or seen psychological thriller films that are chilling and depict terrifying situations. And what is it? I've always been fascinated about this. What is it about frightening novels and films that makes us want to continue to read or watch them? What is that about?
Well, you know, I'm sure you've noticed over the years that Stephen King is probably the best-selling author anywhere at any time. Other authors like James Patterson and Baldacci, they write, although Stephen King, invokes the paranormal very often. Mm-hmm. Sometimes he doesn't. But what lures people is fear. They love to be vicariously frightened for the character.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Exactly. You know, it's a vicarious experience that takes us from the prosaic nature of our lives and at least vicariously puts us in the shoes of the protagonist or whoever it is that's being stalked or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But we survive, and we can distance ourselves. We can close the book at any time. You know, it's the same impulse that makes us take roller coaster rides or go to horror movies or whatever. It's a controlled kind of fear. Some people have said, well, it allows us to at least passively experience and maybe even in a passive way express those most horrific impulses we all have.
Yes.
That may be true to some extent, but I think the larger component is that it lets us experience the fear, but in a tolerable way that we can digest.
Mm-hmm.
It's digestible. It's not overwhelming. It's not catastrophic. It doesn't give us a heart attack, you know.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. It's like Stephen King's essay, it's Why We Crave Horror Movies. And it basically says that, you know, they offer an emotional release for the not so socially acceptable emotions that we all feel on occasion. So it sort of, it does allow us to sort of peek in, like we're the observer, but we have the ability to separate. Then.
We do. And that's also what makes, if you recall, one of his earliest, one of his novels that was made into a film relatively early in his career was Carrie.
Oh, yeah.
And what really made people at least partly love about Carrie was that he was a real underdog who ultimately exacts her revenge.
Right.
And right. That's why revenge movies can be so satisfying.
Oh, yeah.
Because we all have people right. we'd love to take revenge on in one way or another.
Yeah.
Certainly not in an overtly
exactly.
violent, gruesome way.
Right.
But you know, it caters to our own inner fantasies, some of which are basically unacceptable.
It's true. It's true.
There are lots of, you know, if you go on Netflix or you
yeah.
go on any of these online film theaters, you know, whether you use Roku or whatever it is, mm-hmm. you'll see there's a separate category now called revenge movies.
Yes!
Yeah,
exactly. It's like,
before. But they are very popular.
Yeah,
revenge
they are.
Movies.
Of course, I'm feeling frisky today. I'm going to watch some revenge movies.
Michelle, yeah. I have always maintained, and I will always do this in my novels, that
yeah.
the most frightening scenarios, mm-hmm. the most frightening depictions, mm-hmm. and I mentioned this in the Huffington Post article, are the ones that can really happen.
Ugh, yes.
I found
yeah,
Stephen King's
exactly.
novel, Gerald's Game,
yeah.
ultra, ultra frightening
yeah.
because it didn't invoke the paranormal
yes.
or the supernatural.
Yeah.
It takes place in a cabin in Maine,
right.
in the woods,
it's
a
too
husband
real.
And wife.
Exactly.
And everything that happens in that book could happen to you or
that's
to me,
exactly
to anybody.
Right.
And that's
right.
what's the most frightening thing
it is.
Of all.
It sure is. Well, listen, Dr. Mark Rubenstein, we have a hard break coming up with CBS News, and we're out of time. But where can folks find more out about you and listeners pick up your latest novella, The Foot Soldiers, and all of your other books? What would
sure.
be the best way?
My website is Mark Rubenstein, that's markrubinstein-author.com. The Foot Soldier can only be obtained on Amazon. I decided, since it's a novella, it goes for the hefty sum of 99 cents.
Wow! I'm sorry.
Okay,
that's too much.
it's on Amazon and $3 for the paperback, and
great.
It's available on Amazon. The other books are available at Barnes and Noble on Amazon and in various bookstores. If your bookstore
great.
Doesn't have it, they can get it in a day.
All right.
But, you know, the Foot Soldier, I must mention, Michelle, that every single nickel that's made on the Foot Soldier is going, of the author's proceeds, of my proceeds, are going to an organization called DAV.org, which is Disabled American Veterans. .org.
Good
and
for
I
you.
Urge
good
your
for
listeners
you.
To go online.
That's
www.dav.org. This is an organization dedicated to helping disabled American veterans of any war that they've been in, be they psychiatric,
yes.
Psychological
yeah, exactly.
Disabilities or physical disabilities.
Mm-hmm.
And we all know that so many veterans
yeah.
are returning now missing limbs.
Yes, they are.
And,
so, well, bless your heart for doing that. Bless your heart.
Yeah, this is
that's,
not a
that's
money-making
amazing.
Endeavor for
good
me.
Good for
thank
you.
God.
Well, it's an entertaining book, informative, and thanks a million for being such a great guest, as always.
Thank you for having me, Dr.
Yeah.
Michelle.
All right. We'll talk soon. Looking forward to your next book.
Okay.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now. All right, folks, it's about that time. We have to get going. Heartbreak with CBS News coming up. And also, don't forget, if you missed any part of this show, you can listen. All my shows are on iTunes, podcasts, as well as right here on LA Talk Radio in the archives. Pull it up. Be available tomorrow. Thank you so much for listening. And as I always say, do take care of yourself first, and then you'll be great for other people. And that's the way it works. Go within, take care of your own stuff. Understand yourself, and don't beat yourself up, please. All right, take good care, and I'll be back next week. We're going to talk about how to read other people. Bye-bye.